Following the War of 1812, a time of great hardship, danger, and murder on the Illinois frontier, the land along the Mississippi River became a prime area for American settlement. Those who flocked to the region soon found that the frontier was not without its hardships, and many did not survive. The lands along the river were inhospitable and dangerous. No roads existed, and the thick timber often restricted most travel by land. Those who dared the forest took their lives in their own hands. Strange things lurked in the dark woods, and many who ventured into the forest, well, they just never returned. The Indians, the illnesses, and the rough life on the land claimed many lives and gave birth to legends, superstitions, ghost stories, and sometimes something worse. You see, Alton may be one of the most haunted small towns in America, but not everything that haunts the history of Alton is a ghost.
Welcome to the latest episode of American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, and lore of America's past. Hosted by Cody Beck and Troy Taylor, our first season explores the hauntings of Alton, Illinois, one of the most haunted small towns in America. Strange things have been lurking near Alton long before the community gained its reputation for spooks, spirits, and things that go bump in the night. In the early days of the settlement, witches ran rampant, casting spells and bedeviling the local residents. One story told of a boy who was very sick with an illness that no doctor could cure. He remained in bed for more than a month, growing weaker with each passing day. One afternoon, a neighbor stopped by to see the family and told the boy's mother that he had been witched. There was nothing a doctor could do for him. He suggested that they look inside the pillow the boy had been sleeping on. When they did, they found the feathers inside of it had formed into the shape of a wreath, but the wreath was not yet complete. Because it had not made a full circle, the boy might still live. The wreath was removed from the pillow and placed on a chair, and the boy's mother beat the feather wreath until it was destroyed. The next day, an old lady who lived nearby was confined to her bed. She had been, the story said, badly beaten by an unknown assailant with a rope. The boy, on the other hand, was cured of his strange illness and made a full recovery. Another story told of an old woman who lived on a nearby farm. She was elderly, cantankerous, and kept a dozen cats or so naturally, neighbors assumed she was a witch. One summer, all of the cows in the neighborhood stopped giving milk. Suspicious of the old woman, a woman began spying on her and noticed that she kept several towels hanging on her back porch. The woman saw her walk outside one morning and start squeezing the towels until she had four large buckets of milk. Rumors claim the old woman sometimes took the shape of a black cat. The son of a neighbor had apparently shot at the cat when he saw it near the cows in the barn, but he was sure he'd hit it, but the cat ran away. The next morning, the old lady's hands were said to have been crippled up. This is not the scariest encounter. A neighbor decided to wait for the black cat to return. He was prepared. He had melted down a silver dime and molded it into a bullet. He loaded in his rifle and waited inside the barn night after night. Finally, the cat returned, and he shot it. The animal let out a scream and disappeared into the night. The next morning, the neighbor called at the old lady's house, just being neighborly, I'm sure, and found her dead in her bed. She had been shot, but had managed to crawl into her bed. Some local boys decided to follow the blood trail that led to the cabin, and it went all the way to the barn of the neighbor who'd shot the cat with his silver bullet. Another very unusual story of the area concerned a monster, or a ghost, or something, which roamed around a place called Holloway Hill. The creature became known locally as the Bundle. According to the stories, the hill was a wooded area that was crossed by an old, infrequently traveled road. People began to tell a story about a big white bundle that apparently looked like a white cloth bag that came out of the woods at the top of the hill and tumbled down to the road. Farmers who passed by an open wagon suddenly found the bundle sitting next to them on the seat. Riders on horseback would be startled when the white bundle hopped onto the saddle behind them, spooking not only the rider, but the horse as well. There was a local postal carrier who laughed at the story and told everyone he was convinced it wasn't true. One evening as he was driving home, his wagon broke down at the foot of the hill. He was sure that he could fix it, but had to light something by which to make repairs, so he walked to a nearby house to ask for a lantern. The farmer who lived there accompanied him back to the wagon, and they helped him to make the repairs. He offered the lantern to the postman so that he would have a light by which to finish his trip home. Just as the farmer started back to his own house, he heard a yell from the postal carrier. The farmer saw that the bundle had rolled down the hill and was now right next to the wagon. The postal carrier demanded to know the identity of the bundle, but when the bag refused to reply, the man cursed at it. Suddenly, the bundle hopped into the air and knocked the man so hard in the back of the head that he fell from his seat. Then the bundle vanished. Who or what this odd little creature was has never been decided, but suffice it to say, the story makes a unique addition to the stories of strange creatures in the region. Witches, phantom cats, a mysterious spook in a bag, well, all part of the weirdness that's Alton. But what about one of America's most famous monsters? Yes, the Mississippi River bottoms near Alton is also alleged to be the home of Bigfoot. Since the early 1900s, there have been reports of strange man-like beasts that resemble a cross between man and ape. The stories of these creatures predate the coining of the name Bigfoot in the 1950s and have been around almost since the first settlers arrived in the area. Documented reports begin around 1912, when a young woman and her brother spotted several huge hairy monsters in the woods near their home. In 1925, a man with a face like an ape and covered in brown hair was spotted just outside of Alton. In 1929, what looked like a huge gorilla was seen in the woods, and in 1941, a local minister who was hunting squirrels saw something that looked like a baboon in the brush with him. He fired a warning shot, and it disappeared in some underbrush. For nearly two decades, between the 1940s and 1960s, huge prints were frequently discovered in a swampy area along Indian Creek. The creature leaving the tracks was dubbed the Gooseville Bear. Its name came from the tiny community of Gooseville, which is about 3 miles east of Bethalto on Route 140 and not far from Alton. Many locals insisted that the tracks belonged to an actual bear, but others insisted they were too much like those of a man, just really, really large. Whoever or whatever made the prints, no one ever saw it. Eventually, they just stopped, leaving the mystery of the Gooseville Bear unsolved and leaving a community on edge for about 20 years. In May 2004, another weird monster incident occurred on Maple Island, a wildlife preserve located just across the Mississippi River. The heavily wooded area is a popular spot for birdwatchers, fishermen, and outdoor enthusiasts, and in other words, the perfect place for Bigfoot to be hiding. A man and his nephew had gone over to the island to do some fishing. They were at a boat ramp early that morning, getting ready to put their boat into the water. It was still dark outside, so they were startled when a man walked up to them. He was looking for help. He said he'd been fishing nearby and that, quote, some crazy person was throwing rocks at him from the woods. He looked around, but had only seen the man and his nephew nearby. The rocks, he claimed, had been thrown from some woods on the other side of a small creek about 100 feet away. Some of the rocks were so large that if they'd hit him, he could have been seriously hurt. Curious, the nephew got a powerful spotlight out of the truck and aimed it at the trees. He later swore that he saw a set of bluish-white eyes looking back at him. The eyes turned away and all three of the men heard someone, or something, running away through the trees. Whatever it was, he later said, it sure sounded big. But of course, of all of the monster legends of Alton, there is none greater than that of the Piazzaw. As a sort of monstrous mascot of Alton, the modern rendition of it can be found painted on a bluff just outside of town on the Great River Road. This is not a recent work of imagination. Centuries ago, the painting was a petroglyph that showed two views of the mysterious creature. The original painting was first described by French explorers Marquette and Joliet in 1673. In his journal, Father Marquette wrote, "As we were descending the river, we saw high rocks with hideous monsters painted on them, and upon which the bravest Indian dare not look. They are as large as a calf, with head and horns like a goat. Their eyes are red, beard like a tiger's, and a face like a man's. Their tails are so long that they pass over their bodies and between their legs, under their bodies, ending like a fish tail. They are painted red, green, and black, and so well drawn that I could not believe they were drawn by the Indians. For what purpose they were drawn seems to me a mystery." The monster became a landmark on the river. Another explorer wrote about the Piazza in 1698. In 1820, Captain Gideon Spencer asked the local Native Americans about the significance of the monster, and they told him it was a thunderbird that had been placed there long ago. Even into the 19th century, they had offered it tobacco by blowing smoke from their pipes in its direction, and had fired their guns at it to pay honor to its ferocity. In time, the original petroglyphs were lost. They had been painted on a bluff wall just below the site of the Alton Penitentiary. Prisoners at hard labor had quarried away the limestone bluff, destroying the ancient painting in the 1840s. It would not be until four decades later that William McAdams, an Illinois state geologist, created a new rendition of the Piazza, using the recollections of early settlers to the region. It was McAdams who not only saved the description of the Piazza, but also the Native American legend that explained why it had been painted on the bluff in the first place. The word Piazza, it was revealed, meant the bird that devours men. The old legend about the monster was a gruesome one. The legend was traced back to the Illiniwek Indians, who lived in the region before the white settlers came. This local band of Indians was led by a chief named Owatoga, and they hunted and fished the area, living a life of relative peace and contentment until the beast came. One morning, Owatoga's son, Utim, and a friend were fishing when they heard a terrible scream. They looked and saw a huge bird rising from the edge of the river. The stories say the monster was so large that it could carry away a full-grown deer in its claws, and once it obtained a taste for human flesh, it would eat nothing else. Utim said that the monster had a young man in its talons when they saw it, and it carried him away and out of sight. They returned home with the terrible news, but no one believed that a bird could have carried the man very far. They waited all day for him to escape and return, but of course he never came home. In the weeks that followed, the bird returned almost every day. It swooped down on the villagers and carried away men, women, and children. None of them ever returned. The people lived in fear, never sure when the creature might return. Owatoga knew that he had to come up with a way to keep his people safe. He went to his lodge and locked himself inside to fast and pray for guidance. He returned the next morning with a plan that had been revealed to him in a vision. Owatoga took six of his best men and they climbed to the top of the tallest bluff. The young men brought with them only their bows and a quiver of arrows that had been dipped in poison. They hid themselves beneath a rock ledge as Owatoga stepped out to the edge of the bluff. He was a willing sacrifice to the monster. He folded his arms and he waited for the bird to appear. Just then, the sky darkened and the massive wings of the monster were heard. The beast flew toward Owatoga, but as soon as the claws tore into his shoulder, he threw himself down and flattened himself on the rocks. He held tight to the roots of a tree as the monster tried to lift him into the sky. The bird beat its wings furiously, but it could not pull him loose. Owatoga delayed the bird long enough for his men to attack. They rushed out of hiding and began firing their arrows into the monster's chest. As each of the arrows found its mark, the bird released Owatoga and went backwards over the bluff. It spiraled down out of sight and then crashed into the waters of the Mississippi River. The terrible Piazza was never seen again. Owatoga survived his wounds and he and his six warriors were hailed as heroes. As part of the celebration, a colorful tribute to the Piazza was created on the face of the bluff where it had been defeated. From that time on, any Indian who went up or down the river fired an arrow at the image of the Piazza bird in memory of their deliverance from the monster. When the white men settled the region, they heard tales of the Piazza bird and assumed that it was merely a Native American legend, a tall tale, an Indian myth to scare children at night. But what if it wasn't just a story? See, this is where things started to get really weird. In July 1836, a professor at Alton's Shirtlift College named John Russell decided to do a little digging into the Piazzol legend. He knew that it wasn't taken seriously, but he wondered if there might be at least a little bit of truth behind the story. He started going through accounts of people who had heard the story from Native Americans and started doing some exploring in the Mississippi River bluffs, where the story had actually taken place. What he found chilled him to the bone, so to speak. He later wrote of his discovery in an 1848 magazine article. This is what he found in his own words. Near the close of March of the present year, I was induced to visit the bluffs below the mouth of the Illinois River, above that of the Piazzol. My curiosity was principally directed to the examination of a cave, connected with the above tradition as one of those to which the bird had carried his human victims. Preceded by an intelligent guide who carried a spade, I set out on my excursion. The cave was extremely difficult of access, and at one point in our progress, I stood at an elevation of 150 feet on the perpendicular face of the bluff, with barely room to sustain 1 foot. The unbroken wall towered above me, while below me was the river. After a long and perilous climb, we reached the cave, which was about 50 feet above the surface of the river. The roof of the cavern was vaulted, and the top was less than 20 feet high. The shape of the cavern was irregular, but so far as I could judge, the bottom would average 20 by 30 feet. The floor of the cavern throughout its whole extent was one mass of human bones. Skulls and other bones were mingled in the utmost confusion. To what depth they extended, I was unable to decide, but we dug to a depth of 3 or 4 feet in every part of the cavern, and still we found only bones. The remains of thousands must have been deposited here. How and by whom and for what purpose, it is impossible to conjecture. Whoa. The story of the Bone Cave was big news in the middle 19th century. The discovery was announced in magazine articles and books and backed up by other writers and explorers into the 1870s. Was this cave really the lair of the real Piazzol bird? Did it really exist? Did it really carry off Native Americans and eat them? The simple answer to all of these questions is, no one knows. Based on this part of the story, it's possible that there really was a Piazzol bird, but to make things more confusing, none have ever been able to find this cave again. Now, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. There are many remote areas in the Alton area, overgrown by forests, lost among the bluffs, and simply forgotten. Homes, buildings, churches, and cemeteries have all just been abandoned by time, so it's very possible that the same thing could happen with natural formations like caves, hundreds of which are already scattered throughout the bluffs along the river. Could one of them contain thousands of human bones just like Professor Russell described? And if so, does that mean that giant birds like the Piazzol could be real? Maybe. Because before it ends, this episode is going to get just a little bit weirder. In April and May 1948, the Piazzol bird returned to Alton. Well, it might not have been the Piazzol bird, but it was some kind of giant bird, and it was scary. The first sighting occurred on April 4th. Retired U.S. Army Colonel Walter Sigmund spotted a giant bird in the sky above Alton. He had been talking with a local farmer and Colonel Ralph Jackson, head of Alton's Western Military Academy, when he saw the monstrous bird pass by overhead. He ruled out airplanes and gliders and was sure it was a bird, but larger than anything he'd ever seen before. A few days later, a farmer named Robert Price saw the same bird, or at least one of the same size. He swore it was bigger than an airplane. On August 10th, Mr. and Mrs. Clyde Smith and a friend named Les Bacon spotted the bird. It was so big they assumed it was an airplane until it started flapping its wings. On April 24th, an Alton man named E.M. Coleman and his son James saw the bird. They told newspapers that it was enormous, with a body that was shaped like a naval torpedo. It was 500 feet in the air and cast a shadow that was the same size as a Piper Cub airplane at the same elevation. On May 5th, the bird was sighted for the last time in Alton. A man named Arthur Davidson called the police that evening to report the bird flying above the city. Later that same night, Mrs. William Stallings of St. Louis informed the authorities she had also seen it. She said it was as big as a house. A number of sightings occurred in St. Louis over the next week, including a number of reports from police officers. Ironically, though, just as public interest in the bird reached its peak, the sightings stopped. The bird simply vanished. Was the 1948 bird real? Did witnesses, including two military officers, really see something as amazing as they believed they saw? If so, then it's just possible that the Piazzol bird was real too. Maybe it's just not an old legend after all. And if that's the case, are such monsters still out there? In it makes you wonder. And it should make you cautious. Keep the possibility in mind the next time that you're standing out in an open field near Alton and a large shadow suddenly fills the sky overhead. Was it just a cloud passing in front of the sun? Or was it something else?
There's one thing that the American Hauntings podcast knows about, and that's mothers. We featured a lot of great mothers in a lot of our episodes. Pearl Curran, Julia Lemp, Sarah Moore, Marie Laveau, Jane Mansfield, Tamsin Donner, Delphine LaLaurie, Belle Gunness. Okay, maybe leave out those last two. But what I'm saying is that with Mother's Day coming soon, you need a truly special gift for your mom because, well, she's not Belle Gunness. So let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that literally turns your mom's life story into a book. So here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your mom a question in her email, the same way she sends you questions about your dating life or when you plan to give her grandkids. Anyway, these can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you want to ask. She replies by either typing in the answers or by recording her own voice. Then MyLifeInABook.com compiles all her responses into a keepsake book. And they can create an audiobook that uses her voice recordings, preserving her voice and her stories forever. As anyone who doesn't have their mom around anymore can tell you, having your mother's stories about growing up, being a kid, and overcoming life's challenges will be something that you and your kids will treasure. And let's be honest, your mom has given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a very cool way to share them. Honestly, I decided to try this out for myself and I sent it to my mom, and she's not exactly a whiz at computers, but she still found it really easy to use. My mom might have had a little more unusual childhood than a lot of mothers do, so I'm really glad to have this. And I think you'll be glad to give one to your mother too. So check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS for 10% off today.
One story told of a boy. That's stupid. Bestie, where the hell did I even get that? I think it's supposed to be casting.
My favorite part when I go through these is all the outtakes. I put them onto a separate track so I can have a whole thing of him just being like, what the fuck? What is this?
I gotta get a pen.
Welcome to American Hauntings Podcast, where we discuss history, hauntings, legends, lore, and all things paranormal. You are listening to episode 8 of season 1, which delves into the hauntings of Alton, Illinois. I'm your co-host, Cody Beck, and with me, my co-host is author, historian, crime buff, and founder of American Hauntings, Troy Taylor.
Hey, it's not just us.
It's not. We have a full house today,
so yeah. This is fun. So Cody's sister, Casty, is here, Lisa is here, Lux is here. So if you hear, I don't know, something playing on kids' YouTube in the background, that would be Lux.
That's my sister.
Or it could be Lisa. So yeah, we're running on a full house with a whole boatload of monsters.
I'm excited about this.
I know you were.
It's really funny too because I've mentioned this before, but the first time we ever met, and I was in your bookstore, first time I saw you, but I bought that book, the North American Monsters book.
That's right.
And I still have it, and it's funny because there's that iconic still from the Bigfoot video right on the front of it.
I remember the book.
Yeah, I love that book.
Yeah. And it has the Piazzal bird in it.
Yes.
And that's kind of like this, that was one of the things about this episode is, it's not ghosts. I wanted it to be fun, and that was what we talked about. I wanted this to be kind of a fun episode because, and I know we're going to get to this, but I mean, like the bundle. But I know we'll get to that, but I wanted it to be a fun episode because it wasn't ghosts, but you can't have weird things in Alton without the Piazzal bird.
Right,
so we had to make it, and it didn't really fit in our River Road episode, and it's like, I wanted it to be in somewhere. So we just did a whole episode of just
weird things.
Right, the cryptid episode.
Yeah. So.
Yes.
And we are. We should add that we are. We are have again escaped the confines of the past recording studios for the second time. We're back at
Indie.
The American Hauntings offices.
And, I love
which
this
is,
place.
I know it's fun and it's a good spot for it. We just kind of make our own little recording studio in the middle of the floor.
Yeah,
you know, but it works.
Surrounded by skulls.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, well,
it's amazing.
It is that. Yeah,
it's amazing. I love also the first thing I wrote down for notes for this episode when you have the quote, "Not everything that haunts the history of Alton is a ghost," and I love that in general, and it also just reminds me of like Scooby Doo, and it's just like all the monsters like are just people.
Yeah, we
all
just people.
Like,
you know,
I just love
dealing with meddling kids.
Right, so. I love the concept of it. First, okay, I want to start off. You talked about witches, and people just went around casting spells and things and bewitching people. How fun would that have been back then? I know that the consequences could be
dire. That's the problem. I mean, you know, here, you know, like the one story was about an old lady who had a bunch of cats.
Right.
I mean, that's like half the people I know now would be, you know, strung up for witchcraft.
I also want to state that it is true that any woman who has a bunch of cats is a witch. That is a
fact. That is probably a true fact. You're probably right. So, I mean, you know, I think anything that you, back in those days, you know, anything that you could blame your misfortune on something else, I think, you know, and you know, that was an easy target. You know,
right.
was the old lady who's probably her husband's been dead for 20 years. She's living on a farm down the road. And, you know, but some of the stuff was, I don't even know where they came up with some of this stuff. Like the, you know, the woman, I was spying on her and she's hanging towels off her porch. And she goes out in the morning and squeezes all the towels and gets her milk. And then, of course, all of the, you know, the reason for that is because all of the cows in the neighborhood's milk had dried up. So it must be because, you know, this old woman had bewitched them and stole their milk.
Obviously.
You know?
And I love the cantankerous way you described her.
Yeah.
And I also, like, you're talking about it, but I don't understand the logic, right? So you look in the pillow and there's a full circle pillow wreath or almost a full circle. And it's just like all of a sudden you're like, we got her. Like this. This is obviously what's going on.
I think these things, by the time you're talking about settlement in southwestern Illinois, you know, you're talking about the early part or the first quarter of the 19th century.
Right.
By then, people had already traveled from the east to settle into this area. They already had their traditions in place, dating back to the 1600s of witches and witchcraft.
Right.
And so these stories about, you know, that somebody comes to the house and says, oh, you know, this boy, obviously he's bewitched because no one can figure out what's wrong with him. So it must be a witch.
He's
because
got ADHD.
Again, you're looking for an answer to anything, right? So it must be a witch. And, you know, somehow this guy knew, but I'm sure I know this tradition dates back, you know, a century before this, you know, of this, you know, this wreath of feathers inside the pillow.
Yeah, feathers.
You know, and that, I mean, that used to happen. And that's one of those things that dated back to, that's like a funeral tradition where they would actually take out those wreaths out of pillows when someone died.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tie this together in a second, but when someone would die, sometimes they would open up the feather pillow that they had died on and would take out the feathers because, I mean, naturally, when you're laying on a pillow for an extended length of time, you're going to, a full feather pillow,
right.
You're going to push out and make a wreath, a circle of some sort where your head was laying, especially if you haven't been moving. And they would open those up and they would often keep those wreaths. They would put them in a frame and keep them as a reminder of that person.
Okay.
Later on, another mourning tradition was to take the hair of the person who died, especially women who had lots and lots of hair back then, and they would actually cut their hair and weave it into wreaths. And if you, a lot of times we'll go into an antique store, and I've seen, I went into an old, I was with my friend Renee Cruz, we were out in Pennsylvania, we went to this old inn, and there hanging on the wall was this hair wreath, except they didn't know it was made out of hair.
That's
and I said,
weird on
do
so
you,
many levels.
Do you know what this is? And the woman who owned it was, oh no, it's just, it's been there. And, you know, the place was built like in the 1700s,
right.
You know, and it had been there for a long time. And it kind of came with the place. And I said, well, that's a dead woman's hair. And you've got it in a wreath there in your restaurant.
Right. Great.
And it freaked them out a little bit. Well, I mean, it's not like the hair's going to get into people's food, you know. I mean, it was closed up in a frame. But that was a tradition when people died. There were a lot of customs in the 19th century, especially in the latter part of the 19th century, to do with death and dying. I mean, that's a subject of probably numerous podcasts.
Right.
And, people who really specialize in that kind of stuff. I'm not one of them, but it's been something that has always interested me, and funeral customs and traditions are interesting. And in this particular case, people would take that hair and they would weave it into things. Sometimes they made jewelry out of it, like bracelets, necklaces, and that kind of thing, and it would be a way of keeping the person who had died with them. And they didn't see it as weird or gross or morbid like we do now. It's like postmortem photographs. People are like, why would they take pictures of dead people? It's
right.
Like, well, that's how they had to remember them, because people didn't have cameras on their phones because they didn't have phones.
Right.
And so, you know, when you took a picture of somebody back then, that might be the only picture you ever had of them, especially kids.
Right.
People had to, you know, it was a lot of money to go have a portrait taken back then, because people didn't own cameras.
Right.
And so they would, if a kid died and there'd never been another picture taken of them, they would have a photograph taken of the baby so that they would remember them, because that's the only picture they ever had, was one that was taken after death.
Right.
And I know we've gotten off track
feathers, it's fine,
but it's all the same
types
of traditions.
And also, the photos took, what, like 100 years to take? So it's the only time you're going to get somebody to stay still.
Well, there's that, too.
To get a really good picture.
You had to really stand still for a long time. And if you're dead, well, it was a lot easier.
Gosh,
so.
I mean, I don't want to say that our funeral traditions now are that make that
they're
much more
They're
been
very vanilla now.
Yeah, but I do want this on record. I want two kegs on either side of my casket. I want everyone that comes in to get a little bag of tortilla chips, and I'm holding the salsa.
That's a way to go.
You know, I
Why
want people
not?
To have
you
fun.
You should get whatever you want.
I want people to have fun, tell
I'm
the worst stories about me.
I'm starting to lean toward a Viking funeral. So
oh, is
I'm
that where they
put you
out on sea
out
and set you on fire?
Set it on fire.
That's
I think
amazing.
That would be really cool. Right?
That'd be a good way to go.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
So,
okay.
That's now on record, too.
Yes,
so,
as long as, yeah, I'm just happy that we have this down and recording. Okay, so I digress a little bit. So now we're going to go to something that makes, get back to something that makes sense. So tell me
or
about
doesn't.
The bundle.
I don't know. I don't know. I love that story about the bundle. And it's a little, it actually took place a little south of Alton, but it was around in the area.
Yeah.
And it was one of those kind of settlers' traditions. But it's such a great story that, and it's so weird that I just wanted to include it, because any chance I had to talk about this ghostly white laundry bag.
Right.
That's all in my head. All I can see is a laundry bag. Like with, but like with the corners, like four corners of a bag.
Yeah.
And he has little feet on the bottom corners and little hands at the top corners.
It's
kind of
cute.
And it's kind of fun.
Right.
And it's like, why would anyone be scared of this white bag? I mean, I guess if
you're
just
friends.
I guess if you're just riding down, like you're in a wagon and you're going down this dark road at night, and all of the sudden a big white pillow.
Yeah.
Comes running out of the woods. I mean, I just start to laugh.
It's like a costume
I would
from
just,
Charlie Brown or
I
something.
Would like to hang out with this bag. I mean, I would just like to just, like, be his friend.
Well,
but, I mean, to me, it sounds like, and as I told you we were recording, it always reminds me of, like, Oogie Boogie from Nightmare
right.
Before Christmas. He's
right.
like a big bag, you know, except he's full of, like, bugs and stuff. So I don't want that. But just this fun little, like, animated bag. I mean, why is that scary?
Yeah, right.
I don't
It'd
know.
Make for
it's,
a great it, children's cartoon or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, it would.
Sidekick.
I mean, I could see why the postman didn't believe in it.
Yeah.
You know, I get it.
Right.
I totally get it, why he wouldn't think that was could possibly be real.
Yeah,
but
when I was reading the story, I was just thinking how, like, it's always comes back to, like, hitchhiking and hitchhikers and
mm-hmm.
people that just jump up into your car
yeah.
or your wagon.
But
or
see,
whatever.
I can understand why that would be scary. While I would love to meet a vanishing hitchhiker who would disappear out of my car,
yeah.
that would be awesome. I could see why it would be scary.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, you know, you pick somebody up, they get in your car with you. But you're right, that is, like, the beginning of the traditions of the vanishing hitchhiker
mm-hmm.
were people on horseback. I mean, those stories kind of really came to life during the era of America's fascination with cars. I mean, starting in the early 1920s, when everybody had a car,
yeah.
you know, that's when those stories really started to come to life. But if you go back and really trace the beginnings of it, they do go back to horse and buggy days
mm-hmm.
and riding on horseback. And they weren't always fun little bundles of laundry or whatever the bundle was. They were these ghostly girls who showed up who needed a ride to the cemetery. And I think that much more terrifying than picking one up on the side of the road in your car would be riding your horse through the woods at night with no lights, there's no street lights, there's no headlights, you don't have the lights on the dash in your car, and suddenly there's a girl behind you in the saddle or next to you on the wagon seat.
Right.
That would be scary.
That's cause for alarm.
The laundry bag, again, not so much.
Especially
but
when you talk about it, and I just imagine it like barrel rolling down a hill and then jumping onto the wagon. Like, that'd be fun. A girl asked me to take her to the cemetery. Maybe I'm weird, but I kind of like that. But I understand why
it would be scary. Yeah,
right, would
absolutely.
Not. Oh, jeez. Okay, so back to the stories. So Bigfoot, here's my issue with this. So Bigfoot is, supposed to be sighted pretty much everywhere. I mean, all over the world.
But different, though. We're not talking about, and I think these Alton stories, or the Alton area stories, or the American Bottoms, really, is what they refer to that area along the Mississippi.
American Bottoms?
Yeah, that's what that whole area is called.
I didn't hear that before.
They talk about these, like, river apes or swamp apes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same as, like, Bigfoot, I guess. I mean, okay. Don't get me wrong, I'm not an expert on this. I'm not.
You're not?
I find it interesting. No, I'm not. I find it interesting, but that is a whole, it's like UFOs. It's interesting, but that's a whole area. It's a really big rabbit hole that I have no interest in going down too far.
No, that's fine.
But I do find it interesting. But I think we're talking about with these types of Bigfoot, you're not talking about like the ones that they talk about like in Washington or Oregon or up in the mm-hmm. mountains somewhere with these, 8 feet tall, giant, they're talking about these things that are these hairy creatures that live along the river bottoms that don't seem to fit in the category of something that is indigenous to this area.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be here, but yet here they are.
Well, the reason it doesn't jive with me so well is I think what's going on is it's profiling. I think there were, 37 saloons in Grafton?
Well,
I think this is a drunk, hairy guy walking around stumbling in the woods.
There's that possibility as well.
And people are just, they don't know how to describe it. What's more probable?
But the story that freaked me out, though.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, and I know. And I agree with you. A lot of it is really so vague and so little, exists that you don't know what to think. But the story from 2004, though, I mean, that story about the people across the river in the nature preserve, that's at, right?
Is that Maple Island?
Yeah, Maple Island, right across the Mississippi.
Well, so when I was reading that, I was thinking, I'm not trying to like debunk anything, but I was thinking, this sounds just like somebody like on meth or something.
Well,
just a really strong individual
crazy. This guy was talking about rocks being thrown for like 100 feet.
Yeah, right.
And big enough that if they'd hit him, they'd
do some damage.
Cracked his skull. And was, if it had been just one guy down there fishing at night, that's usually a recipe for a lot of bad things.
Right.
But if it had been just one guy, but then here's a couple, this guy and his nephew would come out here early in the morning who are a couple of I don't know. I can't speak for the guy they met.
Right.
But they didn't know him either. But so this is a pair of guys who did see something.
Mm-hmm.
We're pretty freaked out by what they saw.
Well, can you describe where this is, though?
It's right across the river, where you go to, if you go across the Clark Bridge
mm-hmm.
into Missouri, if you go over onto the right is the Lincoln Shields used to be Sunflower Island.
Right, right.
This is the other side.
Okay.
And it's that big open area. There's nothing over there. I mean, it's just woods
where there's
creek,
like a lighthouse
swampy.
And stuff?
Yeah, there's just nothing right there in that little area.
Okay.
And it is it's set aside as a kind of a nature preserve, and it's pretty untouched.
Right.
And the theory about these things, these apes or whatever they are that roam along these rivers.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of the sightings take place. I mean, along the Mississippi and the Ohio and the Illinois, and you get down and you remember, I don't know if you're familiar with it, the big, real famous story out of Arkansas about the Boggy Creek monster.
I don't think so.
Legend of Boggy Creek, and it was a documentary that was done back in the 70s, mm-hmm. and it became like a real big thing because it was about a real creature that was being sighted. But all of this stuff seems to focus around rivers. Like they kind of travel along the rivers.
It's another water thing.
Right. Kind of feed there or whatever. Right. You know, whatever. Again, I'm not a zoologist or a cryptozoologist. Right. So, but I think this is an area where it kind of fits.
Yeah,
with
absolutely.
The sightings, the other sightings that are going on.
For sure.
So, you know, I throw it out there because it's weird.
It's
Alton. And
no, I love it.
So,
I love it. And I mean, I think it deserves to be talked about. And yeah, I mean, this does make sense for a place, you know, for something like that to be, if something like that
it's
exists.
It's going
to
be anywhere. Yeah,
yeah,
it's
absolutely.
It's going to be around Alton, right?
All right. I want to get to the heavy hitter, the one that we couldn't skip over and we couldn't figure out how to fit in any other episode.
So we had to build an episode around it.
Right.
Yeah.
So the Piesaw bird, my first question has to be, so they were offering it secondhand smoke as a tribute?
Yes.
Whereas well, nowadays people
I know,
upset about
I know,
it.
But that was a way of paying tribute back then. So, well, the other thing was that they would blow puffs of smoke at it, but then they would shoot at it too. And I thought,
but I think, I'm getting mixed messages.
I know, bows and arrows and rifles, and you know, they used to say, and part of some of the, I mean, I didn't want to quote from all of the writing about this stuff that this Russell guy had done, but he did a lot of writing and a lot of investigation into the, you know, the actual, was there really a story behind this?
Russell's the professor.
Yeah,
the
one who found the cave.
Right.
And McAdams is the guy who actually created that, what we now see as the picture of the Piesaw bird.
Mm-hmm.
The only things that existed before that looked not, were really crude, really rough looking.
Yeah.
And he created that that picture that we know as the Piesaw bird from recollections of settlers, early settlers who had been living there before it was destroyed.
Right.
And so he tried to come up with the best thing that he could. And I'm sure there was probably some dramatic flair to it.
Well,
in fact, there have been some people who questioned whether it had wings.
Oh, really?
Well, it turns out that, and again, he kept digging. And the reason he put wings on it is because there was a settler who had actually used to go up when he was younger and climb up on the bluff to look at the Piesaw bird. And he said that you would only see the wings after it rained. When the rock got wet, then you could see the outline of the wings. But when it dried, they had faded more than the rest of the petroglyph had.
Right.
So he was convinced, he was sure that it had wings.
Yeah.
So it fit the story. And he was trying to legitimize as much of the story as he could and see if there was any truth to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing about the cave.
It's frustrating.
It's interesting.
Right.
And it is frustrating.
It's frustrating
because it was so widely reported. He published it in literary magazines of the time, and it spread, and it picked up all over the country.
Yeah.
It was in a lot of different things. And then it was confirmed by someone else who claimed they saw it. But no one has ever found it since.
Yeah.
No one's seen it since. And I guess the thing about it that bothers me is you're talking about the mid-1800s into the latter part of the 1800s, pre- and post-Civil War. And there were a lot of stories that were in newspapers back then that weren't necessarily accurate.
I don't know if I believe that.
Yeah.
One second.
Yeah. You know, there were stories that read about how there were men with wings who lived on the moon. You know, people who saw cities on Mars. And people would read this stuff in the newspaper and believe it because, well, it was in the newspaper.
Well, I'm glad we've come so far today that people don't just believe
exactly.
things
See,
like that.
My point is that fake news
been
around for, you know, a century and a half. And that's not to say that he didn't find this cave.
Yeah.
Because, again, you can't prove that he didn't.
Right.
I mean, we haven't been able to prove that he has.
It's easier to prove something exists than to prove something doesn't exist.
Right. And we haven't been able to prove that it doesn't exist because, we haven't been able to find it.
Yeah.
And he swore it was true. So, I mean, he was a professor. I mean, it wasn't like it was some guy who just was Joe Blow who came up with a great story.
He has a little bit of credibility.
Yeah, he does have some credibility.
You would hope.
Being a professor. And I think that does add some legitimacy to the story.
Yeah.
I mean, I would love to see the cave.
Yeah,
believe me.
Of course.
I'd love to see it. But I will also tell you, there is a lot of open land along that river.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of area out there that people have never seen. I mean, some of the places, I mean, I've been out there and explored some places with people who are, you know, natives to the region and have taken me out. I mean, there, we've found houses, you know, churches just completely abandoned and haven't been touched for years just because they're almost impossible to get to on those bluffs.
Yeah.
If there's no road that gets there, the only way to get to some of this stuff now, because the roads are long gone, is to climb up the side of the bluff.
Right. And I mean, how much of the bluffs have we blown up anyway?
And changed or just washed away or eroded over time? You know, I think there's a lot of stuff out there that we don't or can't easily get to. We talked about some of the stuff in our Grafton episode, and we talked about Baby Hollow. I mean, somebody's private property now, but that's not a place you could just stroll up to now, but everybody used to go there at one time.
Right.
So is the cave there? I don't know. I mean, I really don't. I wish I could say one way or another.
Yeah.
But it does make you wonder about the story.
Of course.
I mean, if that cave is real, then that seems to point to the fact that maybe the Piazzale story is real too.
And you know what? I was thinking about it a lot. It reminds me, especially from the book, it reminds me a lot of, I mean, it's a different legends and lore, but it reminds me of the Jersey Devil a lot.
It is. It does.
The way it's described.
Yeah.
And that I made that connection. I was kind of thinking about it. And I mean, that's a whole nother thing we could dive into. And a few other things I noted. I know we mentioned before, like, trying to get these names right, but the Owatoga?
Yeah. Well, that's the best pronunciation I can
find. Reminds me, I just keep thinking of, like, a math problem, or, like, the sine, cosine, tangent stuff. That's all it was bringing up in my head, so it was really hard for me to concentrate on that. There's two last things. One, the bird that devours men is just a badass.
I know, right?
I love that.
Right, I know.
I love that. And the last thing I was thinking, one of the people that was a witness, I guess, was Les Bacon.
I know.
Right then, I don't trust the guy. Who wants Les Bacon?
I know, right? Yeah. Well, that stuff, and again, it's one of those things, and I don't know that we can really connect the 1948 stuff to the Piazzale bird.
Yeah.
But it's weird.
It's super weird.
I mean,
weird,
the giant bird thing is, and I've got friends who are in this field. This is what they do. The giant monsters, the giant birds, and all this stuff. Ken Gerhard is a guy, I've known him for a number of years, and he lives down in Texas. Mm-hmm. And he has been studying winged bird sightings and monsters for forever. And he really digs into this stuff. And he has always been fascinated with these 1948 sightings because there were so many people who were involved in that. And not just in Alton, but once it got over into St. Louis, and I didn't get into much detail on that, but there were a couple of police officers that chased this thing, you know, through the city, these giant birds. And it's like, you know, you don't know what to think of this because, I mean, could it have been, I mean, there's lots of cases where you see something and you think, oh, that thing is gigantic.
Perspective,
and it's really not that big, but it seemed big at the time. Could it have been a big vulture? Sure. You know, but, you know, are there birds big enough to really carry somebody away?
Yeah, I mean,
okay, well, you know, I would say no, you know, other than if it wasn't for this, that and I just gave you a note about it, and I said, ask me about this, because in the summer of 1977, was it 40 years ago this summer, there was a kid named Marlon Lowe in a town called Lawndale, Illinois, which is it's up near Bloomington. It's in the Bloomington area. And he was out playing in the yard with some friends, and his mother was inside the house, heard screams, ran to the door, looked out, and saw two gigantic birds over the backyard, one of which had picked up this kid, who I think was like 8 or 9 years old at the time, picked him up and was trying to carry him away.
Oh, my God.
Got him all the way the length of the backyard, several feet off the ground, rising, and the kid, you know, squirmed himself loose from this bird and fell, and the birds took off. They called the police, and more people saw these birds. It wasn't just this family.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in the, like, the next, over the next several weeks, all the way through Illinois, running from the Bloomington area all the way down to almost to southern Illinois, and then out of the state, people kept reporting seeing these gigantic birds, probably the same birds, all the way that summer through Illinois, flying, landing, taking off, but never carrying away any more kids.
Right.
But, and you know, while they didn't carry him away, the fact that, that it could carry him as far as it did. And then, and you know, there were several eyewitnesses to this. I mean, this is not, this isn't one of those things where somebody made this up and it was a UFO and did experiments on them. This was people saw this bird and then saw the birds right after the fact. So they were really there. I mean, the birds were actually there.
Right.
And there's no reason to disbelieve this story because I from my understanding, I mean, it really kind of messed this them up.
Yeah, I
mean,
bet.
Well, because, you know, people who didn't believe it, who didn't see it, you know, teased them, you know, teased the family.
Right.
You know, used to leave dead birds on their porch and stuff. I mean, just stuff like that.
And, one of the worst.
But, I mean, I really honestly think that something happened.
Well, I mean, that sets a new precedent, right? To know that a bird could, in fact,
could do it.
Pick some, somebody
right. could
up
do
like
it.
That.
It and, was big enough to do it.
And, bird, like, you ever, you know, see, like, a falcon or something up close, even, like, on a glove of somebody from a zoo or whatever, like, they're scary.
Yeah,
I mean, they have
are.
Those talons, you know, and imagine a giant one.
Well,
like
you
that.
Get into, you know, like, these condors and stuff that, you know, have these 18-foot wingspans.
Right.
You know, I've seen them in zoos, but I've never seen them come flying by my head.
Yeah.
But if I did, I don't think I'd be very happy about it.
If I just looked outside and saw, you know, my kid being taken, you know, bird grab, I think it would take my brain a minute to process, like, what's actually going on.
Yeah, what's happening here. Yeah,
that's
I agree
so
with
crazy.
You. I agree with you. Because, you know, one of my favorite weird things, and I can't even say this fits into, like, the zoology or cryptozoology thing because it's so bizarre.
So is, this is bizarre.
This is even more bizarre.
Okay, all right, I'm ready
there.
For
there
it.
Have been stories for years about the legendary Thunderbird photograph.
Okay.
I've written about it. I don't know how many times people have sent me 100 different pictures that are, you know, that they found online somewhere that are Photoshop pictures of cowboys and soldiers standing over this giant dead bird, but. There was an article that ran in the Tombstone Epitaph in the 1880s about these cowboys who shot down this giant bird outside of Tombstone, Arizona, and had brought it in, and they put it up next to a barn, and they measured it and how big this thing was.
Yeah.
And it really did run in the paper. It's a real article. But somehow, somewhere along the line, someone remembered seeing a photograph of this giant bird. And it became one of those things where it became a quest because there were people that were like famous cryptozoologists who supposedly showed a picture, this photograph on a television show in the 1970s and all these things. But no one has ever been able to find this photograph. So it's become like this anomaly of its own. I mean, as if the giant Thunderbird isn't bad enough,
right?
Now the photograph of the Thunderbird has become its own weird thing.
Right. Wow.
Where people remember seeing it. And listen, I swore for years. Now I'm not convinced I ever saw it.
Right.
Now I think it's become like a collective consciousness thing. But
right.
for years I was sure I had seen this picture.
Yeah.
Either in an old book or in an old magazine, because everybody thought, well, maybe it was in like one of those old, and this is way before your time, and you may not be familiar with them at all, but back in the 60s and 70s, there were men's magazines, and I'm not talking about like Playboy, I'm talking
right.
about men's like adventure magazines. I got a book about them somewhere here, but they had names like True, and which had Hemingway on the cover all the time, right? Because they
right.
Real men magazines, and it was True and Saga and Quest and all these very macho one name sounding magazines, you know, and they would always have stories about, well, they did a lot of Bigfoot stories in True and Saga especially, and they would always have, like, you know, Hemingway and Robert Rourke and all these guys were big game hunters of the era. And they were always, you know, I survived the attack by headhunters. It was always that kind of stuff, right?
Okay.
And so they were a step up from the old pulps from the 30s. They were men's magazines, and you know, and men's because women would never read these magazines. I mean, they were very macho magazines, and but everybody became convinced they were in there. Well, years ago, I used to own an old bookstore, and it was a giant warehouse, and we just piles of stuff, and I must have gone through combined 30 years of various men's magazines, and I found lots of articles about Bigfoot and things, but never found the Thunderbird photograph. So it became like this quest for me for a long time. I finally gave it up because I've become convinced we've all imagined we saw this photograph.
Right, implanted of
these
memory.
Men standing with this giant bird that looks like a pterodactyl, you know.
Right.
And but online, you can go online and look for it. You'll find 50 of them.
Yeah.
I mean, there's all these Photoshop pictures that are out there now. But at the time, this was early 90s when this really started going around. So there was no internet. So, and then when the internet came along, then it really became a quest.
Yeah.
And but this giant bird thing, I think, has just fascinated people. And the Alton stuff, that the Pianzal bird ties into these 1948 things, and some of them go back even further. I mean, into the 1800s, there was an incident in Missouri where a school teacher claimed that a giant eagle picked up one of her students and was never seen again.
That's why she lost the kid.
Right,
that
exactly.
Was the
right.
Story
so,
she
you know, yeah, so it's just one of those things that has been around for so long, and the Pianzal bird just kind of fits into it,
yeah.
You know, and it was one of those things where, you know, well, I mean, you know what, you said it best. We couldn't figure out how to get this story into another episode.
But we had to talk
so
about it.
We had to talk about it. We had to build it in. So hopefully you enjoyed this episode and you're still listening and haven't turned it off, because
yep.
I know I went off on a tangent here with Thunderbird photographs and cowboys, but you know, I just think it all kind of ties together, and well, that's what we do here.
Absolutely.
You know, go off on tangents, unfortunately.
And,
so
and my favorite part, and I think it's kind of fitting for the outro, but my favorite part is that after, you know, they killed the Pianzal bird, they would just kind of walk by and shoot arrows and stuff at it. It's kind
yeah.
of like seeing a place you don't like and flipping it off
yeah,
on
yeah,
the car.
Yeah, same kind
know?
Of thing. Yeah, it
yeah.
is. I hate that place.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same kind of thing. So.
Oh, man. All right. Rich, should we wrap it up?
We should wrap it up. You know, and listen, if you've made it this far into the podcast, since it wasn't about ghosts, thank you.
Thank you so much.
But if you did and you liked the show, please, we're begging you to give us reviews on iTunes. A lot of you have been really great and have put something up, and we really appreciate that.
Very much.
You know, good or bad, whatever. It's hard to explain to everybody how it works, but by giving us reviews, it makes it easier for people to find us. We're not trying to get you to kiss our ass. We're really not.
Yeah.
We just want you to put something up so it's easier for new people to find us. And with that said, pass it on to your friends. If you've got people who don't listen to the podcast and you think they would like it, pass it on. You know, we are trying to listen to your comments.
We have taken
you know, a lot of things you've set us into consideration. We've added to the episodes. We've made them longer because
yep.
a lot of you had asked for that. And so we do listen. We do read the reviews. We do listen to your emails and your posts and your comments, and we appreciate all of them. And anyway, keep listening, keep sharing, and thanks again for listening.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. It blows my mind every time I get an email saying, like, someone signed up for email updates from you. You know, we're over 100 now, and then I look at the download numbers, and I'm like, who wants to listen to this bullshit about us? But it means the world to me
yeah.
that people cared or interested. So, yeah, thank you very much. The purpose of this podcast is to combine historic record, folklore, scientific method, observation, and imagination in order to teach you a little bit more about America's most haunted places, including the town of Alton, Illinois. You can learn more about our podcast and find new episodes on iTunes by searching for American Hauntings or by going to www.AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com, where we also have links to some of Troy's books as well as information about his upcoming ghost tours. As for your host, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at CodyBeckSTL or at CodyBeck.com. You can find Troy on Twitter at TroyTaylor13 and on Facebook by searching for the Troy Taylor author page or by going to Facebook.com/AuthorTT. You can also check him out at AmericanHauntings.net. This episode of the podcast was written by Troy Taylor and it was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. Some of the music in this episode was written and recorded by Charlie Brockes at Lighthouse Sounds in Alton, Illinois. Find them at LighthouseSounds.com. American Hauntings is a bi-weekly podcast, and since everyone hates Mondays, we decided to change it to Tuesday. So tune in every Tuesday to receive a brand new paranormal history lesson.